El siguiente es un programa pagado por el anunciante y 1600 AM no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgerdichyan. Welcome you to another episode of our program. Today, my guest is Dr. James Russell. He's the Mashdots Professor of Armenian Studies Emeritus at Harvard University. Thank you for joining me today, James.
Thank you, Barlo.
So the main occasion that we're going to talk about, or the main topic that we're going to talk about, is a newly published work which you translated and annotated called Misak Medzarens, The Complete Lyric Poems. But before we talk about the book, I'd like to just talk to you a little bit about your educational background and also about your research interests, because you have studied not only Armenian studies, of course, but Iranica, Judaica, and several other areas. So could you just tell me a little bit about your research interests and how you got involved in these fields?
Yeah, of course. In high school in New York, I studied Russian and had the good fortune to go to the USSR on a Russian language study tour in 1969, and that included Armenia. And I had met many Armenians growing up in New York City. I even had Armenian classmates. But I didn't really know much about the culture. When we went to Yerevan, I was fascinated, found a teacher when I got back, and then studied Armenian as a minor. I did a Slavic major at Columbia. And then went on to Oxford, where I did a degree in Armenian with Professor Charles Dowsett on medieval Armenian poetry. I wrote a book, Hovhanes Tu Kuransi, in the medieval Armenian lyric tradition, and then did a PhD in Zoroastrian studies at the University of London, at the School of Oriental and African Studies. And my professor, Mary Boyce, deceased, asked me to study pre-Christian religion in Armenia. There's a very large Iranian component in ancient Armenian culture, and it has been studied, but she felt that the religious aspect of it needed a comprehensive study. So I wrote my PhD thesis on Zoroastrian aspects of ancient Armenian religion. And then went on to teach Armenian and ancient Iranian at Columbia and then Harvard, with a year at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, where I also taught both subjects. So I was at Harvard for nearly a quarter century and retired about 5 years ago and moved here to Fresno.
And in terms of the areas that you have been studying, how did you get into Iranian studies? How did that come about?
Well, it was really at a trip to Khorvirab, where St. Gregory the Illuminator was imprisoned. In 1973, I didn't exactly have to camouflage myself, but I tried to blend in as a local because that was a border zone then, and got there anyway. And there's a carving near where you descend into the pit where the saint was imprisoned, which had a cross with a circle, a sundit, around it. And it struck me that the Zoroastrians, the ancient Iranians, worshipped the sun as a divinity, as the fire of the cosmos. And I had noticed already in listening to lectures by Nina Garcayan at Columbia that Armenia had a very strong political and cultural ties to pre-Islamic Iran, especially in the Arsacid or Arshakuni period. So I wanted to pursue that when I got back. And I learned Avestan, the language of the Zoroastrian sacred scriptures, the Avesta, at Oxford, and then did Middle Persian and other pre-Islamic Iranian languages in London. And it was a very fruitful area of study because there's a tremendous amount of material in Armenian ancient literature, folklore, mythology that casts light on many questions one might not otherwise be able to answer in the Iranian field. Not too many Iranists do Armenian studies, although there are some very important exceptions, and many Armenologists tend to look more towards the Byzantine and Christian West than the Zoroastrian East in studying the antiquity of the country or even the folklore. So my work attempted to bridge those two disciplines.
And when you were younger, I was just curious, did you always kind of think of yourself as wanting a career in academics, or did you have another particular interest earlier on in college?
Not really. My father was a lawyer and later in life a judge. My mom was a professor of chemistry. She was the first woman who was tenured in chemistry at City College of New York and had quite an illustrious career as a scientist. I never really wanted to be a lawyer. My father told me I didn't have a poker face, which you need in order to practice that profession. And I couldn't think of anything else. I was no good at athletics and really only interested in languages and literature, folklore, poetry, and things like that. So the only career that seemed obvious to me was the teacher. And I always enjoyed teaching tremendously.
And when you were at Columbia, you did get to interact, right, with Nina Garcayan. Can you tell us a little bit about that and maybe a couple of stories, if there are stories to be told, maybe with your interaction?
Well, sure. I had two teachers at Columbia for a language that is both Eastern Armenian, which was then the dialect taught at Columbia, and Gurapar afterwards. I studied with Dr. Krikor Maksudian, who was also a deacon of the Armenian church, and an extremely learned, man with really encyclopedic learning. And I took Armenian history with Nina, and we've known each other now ever since I was 17. She's now 97, I think, and I'm 67. So it's been a lifelong friendship. And she was a thrilling lecturer. Her voice would kind of drop low, and when she was about to deliver some particularly interesting tidbit, and she had an infectious laugh. And she was a grande dame of the old school. Her family were Armenians from Tiflis and the North Caucasus, many of whom had moved to Moscow. So her mother was a painter who worked with Bachs and other luminaries who designed, amongst other things, sets for the Ballet Russe in Russia before the revolution. After the communist revolution, the family fled to France. Nina was born in France in 1923, and 10 years later, an investment banker cousin of theirs, an Armenian named Shach Tayali in New York, sent them a telegram. He said, this fellow Hitler, who's just been elected in Germany, doesn't seem any good to me. Get a visa now while the getting's good. And so she and her mother moved to New York, and that's how they got out. But they were back in France on holiday when World War II broke out. So the trip on the last civilian passenger ship that left, I think, Le Havre, took weeks and weeks to get to New York because it was dodging the U-boats and the icebergs, and it was very overloaded. So she had a lot of stories about her youth, about her family's fortunes, about other academics, some of which I probably shouldn't tell on the air. There's a lot of that gossip in the profession, as in any profession. I guess the big thing about Nina was once a year around Easter, she would throw a party. She lived in a tiny, exquisite apartment on the east side of Manhattan. She would invite like 100 people, get many cases of French wine, and make a dish. It's a dish the Armenians eat in the North Caucasus called karasuntel. And it's many, many layers of phyllo dough with lots and lots of onions, which are baked down, and fish. And that was her signature piece. It took forever and ever to cook. And she did all of this in a kitchen the size of a small broom closet. And all the luminaries of Colombia, everywhere, they would all crowd into her house. And after all the big shots left and just her pupils were still sitting there, slightly woozy, she would look around with her cat-like smile and say, les artistes chez eux, you know, the artists at home by themselves with each other. Hmm. And then we would have the real conversation, and it was always fantastic fun. And she would bring out crystal goblets of chilled vodka, and she could drink with the best of them. So I guess that's a few anecdotes.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you were talking about some of the languages that you've studied, but you really do have a knack for languages, because can you tell us maybe a little bit of how many languages you know and what you work with?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Russian I learned when I was in the early years of high school, and I've used it all my life, so it's become almost like a native language. Armenian, about the same. I learned it first from a genocide survivor who taught at the Holy Cross Church in Manhattan. And so she taught me both from textbooks, but also in her own particular dialect. She was from Garin, Erzurum. And I had another teacher, actually, at my high school, who used to pull me out of classes to tutor me in Armenian in her office. Her family were from Gesaria, Kayseri. So really learned Armenian as a spoken language, as an everyday language, as well as a literary one. And then just going to Soviet Armenia a few times, I learned Eastern. Again, you know, on the street with people. But to do Armenian studies, you have to be conversant with the various European languages. Scholarship, Turkish helps because many Armenians spoke Turkish. Persian, obviously, because it's a very important neighbor. To some degree, Arabic. I don't claim any proficiency in Arabic, and Sefa Dadoyan is the real expert, I think, in that area. And then, you know, just doing Zoroastrian studies, I went to India and learned the everyday language that the Zoroastrians there, the Parsis, speak, which is called Gujarati. It's spoken in Gujarat, Maharashtra, and Bombay area. My own upbringing, I know Hebrew and a little bit of Aramaic, not very well, studied Syriac. My mom's native language is a medieval dialect of Spanish called Ladino, which the Jews of Spain took with them when we were expelled in the 15th century. My father's family were from Eastern Europe, so they spoke the Judeo-German dialect called Yiddish. In later life, I kind of got interested, for a whole variety of reasons we don't have to get into, in Easter Island in the South Pacific, and partly in deciphering their script called Rongo Rongo. So I learned some of their Polynesian language, Rapa Nui. Anyway, bit here, bit there. I've been trying to learn a little Georgian, but I'm getting too old to pick up new languages, I'm afraid.
You've got a pretty good knack for them, I think. Yeah, I think you could do so. Well, you did your dissertation on Zoroastrianism, which is, of course, several thousand years old, and you've covered a lot of different areas of Armenian literature, myth, mythology, David of Sassoon. But we're going to focus on now on the late 19th century, but really early 20th century, because your interest in the past few years has been to do the translations of some of the major poets of the of Western Armenian, including Bedros Turian, and also the new book, which is the Misak Mezarents book. So can you tell us a little bit how you became interested in the last few years to really focus on this Western Armenian literary canon?
Yeah. Sent the new book, you sent it as a review copy, to a friend, a college friend of mine who was one of the literary lights in America. His name is Leon Wieseltier. He used to be the editor of the New Republic, and now he has his own magazine. And he wrote to me just last night. He said that you're an enemy of oblivion. That is to say, somebody who tries to make sure things aren't forgotten. I became interested in Western Armenian literature because the Eastern Armenian poets I'd been studying were so interested in it. Eastern Armenian has a whole different cultural orientation, much more towards Russia, although also with interest in France. And of course, it's a different dialect, but there were some schools that Western and Eastern Armenians shared. Like symbolism, for example, there's a poet, Vahan Terian. I was fascinated by a poet named Yevtishe Charents from way back when I was a teenager and throughout my whole life. And one thing I noticed was that Charents in the 1930s became extremely interested in the Western Armenian poets who flourished just before the genocide of 1915. And part of the reason for that was that his feeling that that culture should not be lost and that it produced exquisite art, verbal art, which ought to be preserved. And as general editor of the Transcaucasian Publishing House, he shepherded the publication of books of the poetry of various Western Armenian authors. Now, Charents himself was murdered by the secret police during the Great Purge, the Stalinist Great Purge of 1937. And a lot of the work that he began in this area was taken up again by Parur Sevak. Parur Sevak is obviously a post-war Soviet Armenian poet. He did his degree in Moscow. He wrote his PhD on Sayat Nova, the folk bard of Tiflis, who wrote in many languages. And he published and edited and published a two-volume collection of Bedros Turian's work. And I became very interested in this, especially since Parur Sevak shared in some ways the fate of Charents. He was in a fatal car crash in Soviet Armenia. His children survived it. His son told me that although it was an accident, the accident was in many ways engineered by the Soviet authorities and that they had already been making life very hard for Parur Sevak, partly because his championing of the Western Armenian tradition and the memory of the genocide and the memory of Western Armenia in general, they saw this as somehow nationalistic or, I don't know, not as optimistic as they wanted writers to be. So because of that, I felt that, you know, one had to be stubborn and work on this stuff. And Turian had been translated into English here and there, but I wanted to translate the entire corpus, the whole collected works. And I named the book Phosphorus Night because that was the name he gave to the manuscript of a novel, which is lost. It's mentioned by various contemporaries. I think Mihran Turian, who became later the famous archbishop, he talks about it, but it was lost. So I named it Phosphorus Night. And the other poet who I think is Turian's real successor, Turian died in 1872. He was only about 21 years old. He died of tuberculosis. Is Misak Meseret, who was born in 1886. I think that with a kind of a hiatus of a decade and a half, he picks up the torch of Turian. And he's the other really great poet. Diamanto and Taniel Varushan are obviously extremely important, too. I was attracted mostly to Meserent because I saw that there was a kind of connection to Turian, and I wanted to pursue it. And I think that Meserent qualifies not just as the best Western Armenian poet, but as a world poet. I think his works are astonishing. They're entrancing. So that's a kind of an answer, I guess.
Great. We're going to explore a little bit more when we come back from our break. My guest today is Dr. James Russell. He's the Mashdots Professor of Armenian Studies Emeritus at Harvard University, and we'll be back after a brief pause.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgardichian. During the break, we were listening to some music, and the music was from Aram Khachaturian. The piece was Mazurka, which was performed from the Spartacus Suite Number 4, and it was performed by the St. Petersburg State Symphony Orchestra and also later by the Moscow Symphony Orchestra. My guest today is Dr. James Russell. He's the Mashdots Professor of Armenian Studies Emeritus at Harvard University. He is the translator and annotator of a brand new book published by the Armenian Series at California State University, Fresno, a part of the press at California State University, Fresno. Welcome back, Dr. Russell. James?
Hi.
So we were talking right before the break about both Misak Medzarents and also Bedros Turian, and you were talking about Medzarents as being sort of the successor to Turian, born about a decade and a half after Turian's death. But it seems to me that they have a lot in common, don't they? Especially with the premature deaths. I think that is something that probably has affected both of their works. But could you tell me a little bit more and tell our audience a little bit more about some of the similarities in their work, or how Turian led the way or maybe opened the way for a Medzarents?
Sure. Well, Bedros Turian began writing in his late teens only, and then died around his 21st birthday. So his whole creative life is really compressed into a very few years. And in much of that time, he was ill with tuberculosis and knew he was dying. And his poetry explores a number of themes. He was a very boisterous person. He loved the theater. He loved his classmates at school. And he loved taking trips and sitting in orchards on the Bosphorus in Istanbul. And at the same time, he saw that his days were cruelly numbered. He was a romantic poet, so he was constantly talked about love and dreamt of it, which people of that age do anyway, even if they're not romantic poets. And yet he was always so sickly and thin that girls turned away from him. Nowadays, I guess he would have a sort of, heroin chic or something, and he would probably be a superstar. But in those days, that's not what people were looking for. And his poetry is very introspective, and sometimes he invents images to describe inner psychological states. He uses milk, for example, which is the very essence of whiteness, of purity, of that which is maternal and open and kind. And then he speaks of black milk, the black milk of sorrow. It's a very shocking image and counterintuitive. And in another famous poem, he looks at a lake and imagines himself as a profound lake with his heart in the depths of it, and his heart is fiery. And there again, there's this contrast of the cold water of a lake and its placid surface and a fire. This is the poem Le Jug. And Medzarents was in a similar kind of position. He was born in a little village near Dersim called Pingyan, and he had an idyllic childhood. This was an Armenian village that defended itself. It paid tribute to nobody. At one point, it even minted its own money with Armenian inscriptions, and many of the people there were Armenian nobility who had fled to this stronghold when their own principalities in Artsakh or Ani were overwhelmed. So there was a strong freedom-loving sense in the village and superb education, and the Armenians were farmers and scholars and excellent horsemen, and they knew how to defend themselves. And so he had this idyllic childhood, which was full of folklore and mystery and reveries and all kinds of things, and he writes a lot about that. Turian grew up in Istanbul, and he never actually saw the hinterland of Armenia proper. He could dream about it, but he never saw it. For Mezerents, it was different. But then Mezerents and his family moved to Constantinople because of the pressures in the homeland, you know, increasing attacks, marauders, there were the massacres of 1894 to 96. And he spent his formative years, or his early adult years, let's say, in Constantinople, and then he became ill. He tried to conceal it, but again, he was lonely because of his illness and fearful of death, and so a lot of his poems are similar to Turian's in that they're introspective and full of reveries. The difference, though, is this early happy childhood in nature. And so there's a kind of a sunlight that breaks through all the time, which makes him very different from Turian. Also, he lived a little longer. His poetic output was larger. And Turian had really invented the modern Western Armenian literary language almost single-handed. By the time Mezerents inherited it, it had developed. And so he could play with it. And one of the things he does, one of the things that makes his poetry so intricate and so rich, is to combine the registers, the levels of everyday spoken Western Armenian, classical Armenian of the liturgy, the Badarak, the classical Armenian of the early historiographers like Moses Korenasi, Pastos Fuzan, the medieval mystical Armenian of Shnor Hali and Narigatsi, various other contemporary Armenian poets, particularly Turian Beshik Tashlian, but also all sorts of folkloric language. He speaks of various kinds of supernatural beings in his poems, which are very, very imaginative. Yeah. So his language is very rich. It's like polyphony. It's as though there are several different tunes going on at once that interweave with each other at different levels, some below the surface. And then he loves to do word games. So in that sense, he's unique. He is a successor to Turian, not just an imitator. In fact, he doesn't imitate all that much, really.
Well, he must have been an extensive reader, wasn't he, then, in order to just bring all of that into his world and then to you know, produce those poems. He must have really been reading quite a bit.
Yeah, he not only knew all of the Armenian classics and all of contemporary Armenian literature. He read French and English. He was interested in the French and English Romantic poets. I think he knew Turkish. He doesn't use much of it, except for words like hashish, to give a kind of actually an exotic tinge to his poems. Well, he also hung around the editorial offices of the Armenian literary magazine. He made friends with people like Aram Antonian, who were many years his senior, and just hung out with them and drank coffee, and the conversation was very wide-ranging and literary. Right at the end of his life, the newspaper Aztag began to be published, and when you leaf through it, it's full of translations from all over, and correspondence, political and other correspondence from all over. And you got to remember that Constantinople, at the time when Mezerents lived there, and even when Turian lived there, was a very, very cosmopolitan city. People from it was an imperial capital. People from every European traveled there and worked there, your average ferry ticket or ticket for a parking space could be in four languages or more, including Armenian. So it would have been surprising had he not been widely read. And he was extremely curious, and we have memoirs of him which talk about how friendly he was, how people were attracted to him.
And one of the most significant things I think you do in the new book, which is again called Misak Medzarens, The Complete Lyric Poems, is that you've annotated and added your commentary. So tell us a little bit about that process, because I think that really enriches the person's understanding of that translation.
Well, thanks. I wanted to introduce the poem. The poems can be read on their own and enjoyed on their own without reading the commentary. And I hope that people won't be bogged down in thinking that they have to do a university course in philology just to enjoy a poem. But the deeper you go, the more you can find. So that, for example, I focus on some of the background of the vocabulary he uses. He has one word, for example, which doesn't exist as far as they know in any other language, terahosan, which means flowing with fire. Now, how does something flow with fire? Fire is fire, water is water. But poetry enables us to imagine things that are contradictory in reality. And in fact, the word is used in the Chorvurt Chorin, in the Hymn of Vesting. So I talk about that at some length. At another point, he has a pun on two Armenian words, anantnagan with a tso, which means not passing, or permanent, and anantakan, which means without personality or with self-devotion, generously. And he sees that which is lasting, that which will remain, which is chiantsnir, doesn't pass, is that which is anansnagan, which is impersonal. That is to say, where you break out of the shell of your ego and help others. And he uses this in the context of a poem in which he makes a further very intricate pun on the word antrev, which means rain, and arev, which means sun. And he says, our language, he says, contains the word for sun in our word for rain. And if you look at antrev, if you take out the you act and the nu, you actually do get so keep the R. But the point is that these are word figures. Now, the word figures aren't just an occasion to display learning. The poet lives with language. A poet uses words. A poet has this inspiration which he can trace, which comes like a lightning bolt, and then he has to sort it out and write a poem. And so the words are the way in which a poet processes his idea. And the intricacy of the words, because poetic words are very, very brief and dense, and unlike prose where you spell everything out, we can see, if we look carefully at his language, what his thought processes are, even his subconscious thought processes. And very often these are things he might not even have been fully aware of when he was writing the poem itself. The brain is on fire and doing all of these things with the words of the language, and he has this extraordinarily rich language with many historical layers, all of which he deploys in making a poem. And of course, it's not just the words themselves either, it's the sound. A poem has to have a sound, but the Armenian language is a sound. So in order to do justice to that, I had to discuss the sounds of the words, the sound patterns. puzzles involving words when you pull them apart. And then the sources, for example, like just one word, janshken, which is a word meaning the dappled color of a particular kind of piebald horse, refers you back to Pabstos Buzan's story about such a piebald horse and a prince who had it and the Persians wanted it. And then that story may be a source, actually, of a very important folk epic called Kirilu, the son of the blind man, and things like that. So I've gone into a lot of detail analyzing his language, looking at its patterns, and so on. And I think this helps one to understand the particular culture he's coming from. He's a world poet. Before we did this interview, I just made a kind of a short list as I looked through the book myself of some other poets I've cited or talked about in order to elucidate who Mezarant was and what he was doing. And these include Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Dylan Thomas, Edgar Allan Poe, Hart Crane, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Allen Ginsberg, William Blake, and even Jim Morrison, not to mention poets in other languages. I'm just listing the ones in English. I've also cited Hebrew poetry from the Middle Ages, Persian poetry, and so on. And so this is the point at which you understand that Mezarant belongs to a kind of republic of letters, that there's this immortal gathering of creative people somewhere in the universe who correspond with each other, who communicate with each other, and he belongs to this. That was another purpose.
Yeah, I'd like
because
to.
Because very
yeah.
often.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm gonna interrupt you for just a moment. We're going to continue that thought because we need to take a break, James. But we're going to come back, and when we come back, we're going to continue that thought because I was going to ask you about his role in world poetry. My guest today is Dr. James Russell. We're going to take a brief pause and come back on All Things Armenian in just a moment.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Demirgardichian. During our break, we were listening to Lezginka by Aram Khachaturian, which was performed by the St. Petersburg State Symphony Orchestra. So during today's discussion. My guest has been Dr. James Russell. He's the Mashtots Professor of Armenian Studies Emeritus at Harvard University. He has just had his new book published called Misak Mezarents, The Complete Lyric Poems. He did the translation of nearly 200 of Mezarents' poems and also did commentary and annotation. So thank you, James, for joining me today.
Thank you, Barlow.
And we were talking right before the break, and it was the topic of Mezarents as being not just an Armenian poet, but a world poet. And you were reading a list of some of the other poets that you felt he was, I guess, similar to? Or tell us a little bit about how you situate him in the world poetry.
Well, when you translate a poet from one language into another, I think the main thing is to be faithful to the poet, of course. It's very hard, considering Armenian and English have such different cultural universes and are such different languages. So I think that while being as accurate as possible, at the same time to convey the spirit and the flavor of the poem, you have to use your own resources, the poems you know that seem to be most similar in their spirit to the poet whose work you're trying to render into a new language. And for me, a lot of the English romantic poets and American romantic poets of the 19th and 20th century, it's strange to speak of a romantic poet as 20th century. It's an old movement, but I have reasons for doing this. They seem to help the best. So, for example, Edgar Allan Poe. Edgar Allan Poe has one poem in which the key word, the whole poem is constructed around it, really, is a word, porphyrogy, which is obviously not an everyday English word, but it means born to the purple. Purple is meaning royal purple, that is to say of noble birth, but it also includes the word porphyros, purple. And as it happens, this word is quite common in Armenian. Armenian takes this Greek compound word and renders it as ziranedzim. Zirani is purple or golden. It's also the color of an apricot. It's also the color of the seed, Zirani Zog. So it's reddish, purplish, golden, blue. You have to rethink the way you understand color when you read Armenian. So Mezarant uses Ziranedzin, which is quite a common word, actually, in medieval Armenian. And the word Zirani is one of his favorite colors because of its polyvalence, its multiple capacities, and also because of its sound, because Zov, Zananal, to be born, the sea, all of these things have the same sound as Zirani. And is a marked sound. When a child is born, he or she learns a number of other simpler sounds before being able to pronounce a sound like the. So even in Armenian, which has many such sounds, it's a marked sound. It kind of jumps out when you see it. And so I read Poe, and Poe kind of helped me to translate Mezarant. And then there are some kind of ecstatic stream of consciousness poems that Mezarant has, for which I liked Coleridge, who throws in extravagant imagery, Hart Crane, who's extremely difficult to pull apart. You have to kind of read the poem and appreciate it and then study it. Allen Ginsberg, who has incantatory poems. William Blake, who's a visionary, and Mezarant is very prophetic and visionary in many ways. So the translation reflects the inspiration of this background of poetry in English. There was one poem in particular I really love, called Incharpet Sutyam, with what intoxication. And when people read the book, as I hope they will, I hope they'll enjoy it and first just understand the poem, read it, feel it, before trying to analyze it, in which he has this entirely universal love. This nature just for him explodes in the poem. There's no way to paraphrase it. you just have to read it. It says what it says. Then there are some other poets who I think Mezarin anticipates in an uncanny way. The book actually is missing its final two pages. There was a printer's devil, it's called. This happens, you know, no matter how much attention one pays to a book. The last two pages of the book somehow didn't get printed, and these are fragments of poems that Mezarin didn't actually publish. They're just fragments, but the fragments are interesting. They seem to anticipate a completely new style. It was more strident, more urban, darker, and the style, in an uncanny way, I think, is prophetic. It looks like Mayakovsky, the great Russian revolutionary poet, with his abrupt staccato, short line, or Cherenkov's revolutionary poems, the things he wrote during the genocide and then right after, during the Russian Revolution, and then in the very turbulent years of the Armenian Civil War and the establishment of Soviet rule, a style he then moved away from. But Mezarin actually anticipated it a full decade before anybody had a sense of it, and sometimes even the very words he uses in these few fragments anticipate what Cherenkov was going to use. For example, the word fork, flaming, or fiery, which is something he doesn't usually use, but Cherenkov uses it in his great poem, Mahvan Desil, The Vision of Death. So these are some of the ways that Mezarin fits into world poetry. But there's another thing. See, he's been translated. A lot of his material has been translated into Russian. He's not an unknown poet to Russian readers, but he deserves a place in English poetry, in American poetry. The Americans and English people tend to read a lot less of translated literature than, say, Europeans do. Maybe it's the two oceans. We seem to be separate from the rest of the world. But I think that Armenian literature has a place. It ought to be known that Armenian literature isn't just an ethnic curiosity or something from a faraway place that no one is going to visit, whose name we can't pronounce. It's part of our heritage. And that's part of the reason I moved to Fresno when I retired. I mean, I think that our Armenian contribution to the human story, both the lyric and the tragic and the romantic and the sumptuous, because a lot of veteran poetry is reveries and imagined feasts and mystical unions and nights, all of this enriches life. All of this helps make our own lives right here richer. So really what I'm hoping is that people will read the book not out of an obligation to study literature, not just out of an ethnic pride, but actually for pleasure, for the experience of the soul.
The book is Misak Mezarin's The Complete Lyric Poems, and my guest has been the translator, Dr. James Russell, who is the Mashdots Professor of Armenian Studies Emeritus at Harvard University. The book is available through Abril Bookstores in Los Angeles. Thank you very much for joining us today, James.
Thank you, Barlow. It was great.
And Dr. Russell will be speaking for the Armenian Studies program on Thursday, March the 11th at 7 p.m., on a Zoom webinar, where he will be discussing the book, Misak Mezarin's The Complete Lyric Poems. So go on to our website at fresnostate.edu/Armenian Studies to find that link. And also join us this Saturday at 10 o'clock in the morning for a discussion by Tatul Hagopian. He's an independent journalist who will talk about the war that took place in Karabakh in September to November of last year. For All Things Armenian, this is your host, Professor Barlow Dermogradichian, wishing you a good week ahead, and we'll see you next Sunday for another episode of All Things Armenian.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Este fue un programa pagado y solo refleja la opinión de sus anunciantes. Ahora continúa disfrutando de la programación de 1600 AM.